Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Frank Soloway is our guest, and Bill Russell is here, too, and I'm going to let you talk. I am.
Right.
But first, you were talking about a revolution, and I think we are in another time of revolution. I credit Bill Calvin with saying to me, to us, that the work of Darwin, the Darwinian perspective, may be as important as coming to an understanding of chemical bonding. That we may be looking at something that is a part of nature to which you were referring, and that we are not apart from nature, we are a part of nature. Let's go back again to Darwin, this concept of a revolution. If we are living in a time that has that kind of radical change, what are you learning as you look at birth order and Darwin in this time that is another revolution?
Well, I think it's important to recognize the Darwinian revolution is still going on. It began in 1859 with the publication of The Origin of Species, which had one interesting sentence toward the very end of the book in which Darwin somewhat cryptically and even modestly said, light will be thrown on man.
Welcome back into nature, humans.
And indeed, of course, he took a lot of heat for The Origin, and would have taken even more if he'd stuffed it with all the ideas he had on the evolution of man. But he did come out 10 years later, a decade later, with one of his most famous books, The Descent of Man, and showed how far you can go in understanding human behavior by applying an evolutionary interpretation to it. We represent genetically the history of 3.5 billion years of evolution on Earth.
We as humans,
all species do. We're all descended from the original forms of life, and the genetic code of every organism has a kind of history to it. It's all quirky things that happen to us that have encoded the success stories of surviving amidst all of the perils of a world full of predators and so forth. So we have, every species has lots of quirks here and there. Darwin was fascinated by the fact that the facial muscles in humans that are used for various expressions like smiling, laughing, crying, are the same facial muscles used by primates when they make the same grimaces. So the anatomy of the face betrays itself, really, or betrays the evolutionary bond that connects us with primates.
Take that, if you will, directly to your work looking at siblings within a family, because as I understand what you're saying, this same Darwinian process works within families and distinguishes one sibling from the next in really important ways. Is that right?
Yes. The great challenge for children today and children perennially in the past has been the task of getting out of childhood alive.
Alive?
Alive, yes.
You don't mean really alive, this figuratively.
No, I mean really alive. If you don't get out of childhood alive, your genes don't get passed on. They are eliminated from the gene pool. And so we are all descended from children who made it out of childhood alive. Not one of our ancestors
died before they could reproduce.
Exactly. And so all of them negotiated the problem of childhood. Now, we know from the study of every species, particularly social species, that offspring compete for parental investment, parental love, affection, instruction. Anything that will help an offspring get out of childhood alive is considered an investment by parents in most social species.
So, and are those scarce resources?
It's a scarce resource. Parents only have so much that they can invest, usually, in their offspring. And so there's competition among siblings for that scarce resource. And birth order enters the picture because it defines differently the niches that are available to offspring in the family, and also defines differently the kinds of strategies that they can employ effectively in competing with their rivals, other siblings.
Now, you're talking about niches in the Darwinian sense and competing in the Darwinian sense of the great ways that nature decides who goes on and who doesn't, yes?
Yes, but we can also talk about this in a perfectly intuitively psychological sense. We all know what we mean when we say family. Families have niches. It's a place that each, or a role that each child occupies. It's a little different.
Like what?
From, the role of a surrogate parent. Firstborns are much more likely to occupy that role, to assist in child-rearing tasks. It's a natural niche. It's a great way to suck up to parental authority and favor.
And it works, too,
it
doesn't
works.
It?
I mean, you're a fool as a firstborn if you don't take advantage of it. And so, on average, firstborns do. Now, let's compare that with a younger sibling. It's very difficult for a younger sibling to babysit themselves. In that sense, the niche of the surrogate parent really isn't open to them. They know that perfectly well.
And no book had to tell them that. They just know it.
Right. You know your parents. You can't raise your hand and say, I volunteer to babysit myself. The parents know when they come back, the house will be in ruins.
You can't
let
it,
you get away with
work.
That. They might allow your 12-year-old sibling to babysit you, but not you. And so there's a difference in the kind of niche that's open and also the kind of behaviors that ensue from it. What do firstborns do because they can be a surrogate parent? Well, they tend to do all the things that parents value. Parents value us all doing well in school, so firstborns do their homework. They're conscientious. They respect parental authority because they're acting as a parent themselves and copying parental authority, so they tend to identify with parents and parental authority. That makes them more conforming and more conventional. Firstborns are bigger than their younger siblings,
always.
Obviously.
Until you get to be grown.
Right. They're bigger throughout childhood. They're bigger and stronger and smarter.
And that's not irrelevant.
No, they use the advantages of age, size, and status as a powerful a strategy or even weapon in sibling rivalry. If you're firstborn, you want something from your younger sibling, in effect, you can take it.
Whereas, because you're bigger and you're stronger and you're older and you've got the authority.
Right. Now, if you're a younger sibling, you have to be careful about the use of physical violence. If you go up and punch an elder sibling, problem is they can punch you harder.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do not
win. Do I hear Cain and Abel in here? Do I hear this?
Well, Cain and Abel had their problems.
but you're talking about over millennia. You're not talking about lately. You're talking about how primates who are humans relate in families. You're talking about big sweeping generalizations about people in families and sibling position, yes?
Actually, I'm talking at two different levels. One is what's happened historically going back hundreds of thousands of years. These differences in niches were always there, and so siblings have been playing out these strategies for a long time, and so we have every reason to believe that siblings come into the world hardwired for the ability to take advantage of these strategies. But there are no genetic differences on average between siblings, so there's no genes for being a firstborn or genes for being a laterborn.
So what's the difference between that and being hardwired?
What you've said to this point sounds like it is the kind of argument that could be made in the scholastic tradition. By reason. It's intuitively obvious these things are the case. And I think you're about to go the next step.
Yes.
The magic step, which is to apply scientific principles, methodologies, and the Darwinian view. Is that correct?
Absolutely. What we've been talking about are hypotheses to explain differences in behavior. That's the first step that you take in science. The next step is the really crucial one. You've got to go out and test that hypothesis. All the hypotheses in the world, plausible as they may seem, do not make a science a science. It's that second step, and the second step is the hard one. So what tests, for example, could we make? By hypothesizing about family dynamics, we conclude that firstborns ought to be more conscientious and conventional. That doesn't make them conscientious and conventional. It's only by studying their personalities that we find out if that's true or not. And when we survey the existing literature on birth order, which is a very, very large literature, those two hypotheses are overwhelmingly true.
Both of them being one and two.
Firstborns are significantly more conscientious, more likely to emulate parental values, more concerned about ambition and achievement, all things that are related to conscientiousness. Secondly, firstborns are more respectful of parental authority and authority in general, and that means that during, say, radical revolutions, they tend to side with the status quo. They were the great opponents of Darwin and the great opponents of Isaac Newton and the great opponents of Bacon and Descartes and the experimental method.
We're going to be back in just a moment to follow the thread of how does your science apply to what you say. I'm going to bait this one, guys. You say that revolutions start within families, not necessarily between them. We'll come back to that in just a minute. This is the Paula Gordon Show. We're with Frank Soloway at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bill Russell's here. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.